Affordable housing is getting harder to find in South Florida. We get a peek into Cuba's legal system, and the U.S. Supreme Court could force thousands of Floridians off of Obamacare. Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, where we discuss the week that was. Demand for apartments and homes is up in South Florida, which means rents are climbing. So much so that large portions of the population are paying close to 40 or 50% of their income on housing costs. What will happen when there's no more affordable housing? Becoming a lawyer in Cuba is very different from that of the United States. A group of Florida attorneys recently went to Cuba to find out just how different. Finally, lawmakers in Tallahassee fight it out over Medicaid expansion, and the U.S. Supreme Court could impact Obamacare customers. It's all ahead with your input on the Florida Roundup, next on WLRN. Good afternoon, I'm Luis Hernandez, and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Miami is one of the most expensive cities in the country to rent. A 2013 New York University report showed that about one-third of renters in Miami spend half of their income on rent and utilities. All right, let's face it, demand is up. Counties are looking to get the most tax bang for the buck. That makes affordable housing hard to find. We're going to tackle the issue of affordable housing and rising rents, and we want to hear from you. How are you coping in this market? Are you forced to commute long distances to get to work? Are you forced to live in a community that maybe you find questionable? Are you considering leaving, trying to restart your life in a more affordable city, maybe even state? Give us a call, 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Tell us what community you live in and tell us your experience trying to find affordable housing. Joining us now in the studio, Brian Bandel. He's a reporter with the South Florida Business Journal. Brian, great to have you.
Thank you very much for having me on this Friday.
We hear these reports about housing values are going up, home sales are going up, the economy's getting better. We know that's not the case for everybody, but when you look at housing in Palm Beach County, Broward, Miami-Dade, what jumps out at you? What do you think of all these figures?
Well, there's the values and then there's the economic reality, and they're not necessarily connected. The values that are increasing are mostly connected to the outside investors, many of them international investors, trying to safeguard their money, people from the Northeast, some of them very wealthy company owners that want high-priced homes here. It's not necessarily connected to the high wages in the local economy. So you might look at a city like San Francisco, a lot of high prices there. Well, that's because of the tech boom in San Francisco, Google paying
people
a lot of money.
It.
We're not getting a lot of six-figure jobs being created here, like Google and Facebook are creating them over there. So because of that, you have large growth in rent and housing prices, but not a lot of growth in wage. According to CBRE, 6% increase in the rent in Miami, 7% increase in Broward. But the government says wages only increased about 2% last year, which is just below the national average.
So it seems like outside investment, outsiders are really prospering the most in our communities when it comes to housing, not really Miamians and people in Fort Lauderdale, people in West Palm Beach, right?
Yeah, I mean, for the local people, it's becoming a lot harder to live. According to the University of Florida, there are about 1.1 million South Florida residents who spend over 30% of their income on housing, including almost 600,000 who spend over half of their income for shelter. And it's becoming tougher. I mean, and you look at the amount of new college graduates who can live here. It's very tough on that salary. And we just don't have the huge amount of job creation. We have just mostly a lot of service sector jobs, and it's not easy to make it there.
You know what? Let's look at what a healthy rent should be. I mean, what in a person or a family situation, what would be a really good healthy amount to pay of your income so that you can sustain yourself and your family, but also be able to give back to the economy by buying things?
So the benchmark rate is about 30% of your income should be spent on housing. But when you look at some of the communities here, that's really tough to do. So you look at downtown Miami, according to CBRE, the average asking rent is about $2,000. So that, if you do the math, that's about $72,000 a year in order to spend only a third on that.
Which is hard to do if you work in a restaurant or if you're working in retail.
Yeah, absolutely. Not a lot of people make $72,000 a year. And you look at, you know, so maybe you double up, maybe you find a roommate. A lot of people are extending the college dorm experience to after they get out of college for maybe, you know, for a number of years because they need to get two or three people in there to afford it.
Brian, I haven't been in college in a long time, so I don't know if I want to go back to that. I also found a University of Florida report, again, from 2013, so I can only imagine these numbers may have increased. Again, 1.1 million people in South Florida spend about a third or more of their income on housing, more than 500,000 at 50%. When you get to those kind of numbers, really, people are being squeezed. But what's that doing to people and families? What does that do to communities?
Well, it means that those people have to make some very difficult choices with the way they spend their money for things besides housing. You might say, I can't buy the clothes I want. I can't send my kid to the school I want, or, you know, save for my child's education the way I want. Maybe I don't drive the car I want to drive, you know, don't get the nicest car, or maybe I'll have to take the bus instead. So they have to make those hard choices because the housing costs, it's there. It's something that it's really tough to change. Everything else you can change, it constrains spending of the whole economy.
Can you put this on one thing? Can you point to one reason why there's less affordable housing right now in South Florida than 10 years ago? Is there one culprit?
It's a function of the supply and demand, versus, you know, the income growth. So you had a situation 10 years ago in the last recession. They, according to CBRE, they converted about 60,000 apartments to condos. So that hurts the supply right there. During the recession, they weren't building much of anything, including apartments.
Do we still see a lot of the condo conversion?
Very little. I mean, they don't need to because everyone's spending so much money buying apartments and raising the rent. So they don't need to convert them to make money. And then, as you know, during the recession, a lot of people were in foreclosure, so the rate of home ownership plummeted. You know, before the recession, about 71% of people in South Florida owned homes. Now it's 59%. So you have a bunch of people thrown into the rental pool. Then, you know, wages were stagnant or falling during that time, so it was harder to afford a home. And now it's harder to get a loan because, you know, before you only needed to just sign on the dotted line. Now you actually have to, you know, prove you make money and have a credit score.
So now it seems like they're just more piled up on top of anybody who even wants to own a home. But, you know, it kind of goes back to what you said a little while ago. I want to get to this idea of who is buying then, because if we still have foreclosures that are being processed, there's still properties out there to buy, but people either can't get the loans or they just can't afford, so they have to rent. Who's buying this stuff?
Well, a lot of it's international investors, people from the Northeast. Although everyone in the condo industry is pretty much saying that it's slowing down a little bit because the U.S. dollar is stronger versus the foreign currency. So, you know, if you're in Venezuela or Russia, your currency doesn't buy as much dollars as it did before. But there are still people who, because of inflation or problems in their country, they say, even if I go to Miami and my money loses 5% a year, you know, even if I have to rent out this investment and not cover my cash flow, it's still better than keeping it in Venezuela, where I had 50% inflation a year, something crazy like that, you know, where I'm not confident in the economy, you know. So it's sort of like their bank account.
We are talking about affordable housing in South Florida. It is harder and harder to find in communities from Palm Beach County to Broward to Miami-Dade. As we've heard some of the numbers, there's a growing number of South Florida residents who are now spending 40 to 50% of their income on housing and utilities alone. And wondering if you're in a particular community right now and you're having a hard time finding affordable housing, what's it like for you? Tell us what community you're in. Tell us what your search has been like. Maybe you're considering getting out. Maybe you see those lists of cities across the country that are much more attractive to live in because housing is a little bit lower. Maybe cost of living is a little bit lower. Are you considering that? Again, the number is 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Let's go to the phones. I want to go to Nathan, who lives in Miami. Nathan, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I actually am just moving in to our apartment right now. I'm actually unpacking boxes. We just moved in yesterday to our new apartment. And I can tell you that our search was exhausting just to find anything that was in our price range. We found a one-bedroom apartment for $1,300 a month, which to my friends even in Washington, D.C., sounds obscene. And we had to move all the way south to the Falls, and we were living in the urban core before. And I can actually say that I was speaking to the woman at Public Storage, the manager there, yesterday as I was getting the last of our things out of storage. And she said that she was shocked that we found an apartment in a month, and that a lot of her customers are actually waiting up to 6 months with their things in storage just to find anything in their price range. So my question for the guest is there really any hope of affordable housing ever returning to the urban core in Miami?
Oh, my goodness, Brian.
Well, when you talk about the urban core, here's what I'm hearing from developers. They want to build smaller units so they're less expensive. I've heard this from Carlos Rosso at the Related Group. I've heard this from Michael Simpkins when he wants to build an innovation district in the Overtown area. And they're all trying to work with Miami 21 allows, you know, there's a certain limit of size, about 850 square feet. So different developers are saying, how can I build a little smaller than that or reduce the parking requirements in these buildings so it's less expensive, I can charge less? Michael Simpkins said, well, maybe I could build a 300 square foot unit and still, you know, lease it out, you know, for maybe $1,000 a month or something like that. If I build a whole lot of them, have nice amenities in the building. You know, that will require a bit of a zoning change, but that might be the solution to get what they call micro units.
Going smaller, and we kind of see this idea of maybe living a smaller, simpler life. Nathan, thank you so much for the call, and congratulations on finding a place. I'll let you get back there to your packing. Let's go back to the phones. I'm going to go to Wanda now in Miami. Wanda, welcome to the program.
Hey there, guys.
All right, so what's your experience been like?
Well, my experience is right now I'm trying to find a house, have been trying to either buy a house because renting seems like it's just, I can't afford to rent. I'm a first-time homeowner, hopefully. But the problem for me is animals. I have three dogs. I've rescued dogs for the last few years. And there's so many homeless animals, and now that's just seeming to cause other people homeless. Or it's either more homeless animals or more homeless people, or more crazy, outrageous rent, and I don't know what's the answer. Broward or Miami-Dade?
All right, so trying to find, you know what, that's almost a whole other segment in and of itself, and, you know, that also increases costs.
Yeah, I mean, single-family homes are better, you know, if you have a neighborhood association that's okay with having animals, that's probably better. I know condos can be tough with animals. They have their own different rules, but you know, definitely single family homes there are some kind of emerging neighborhoods a little north of downtown Miami that are, you know, that are people are beginning to like a little bit more. So maybe you could find something around there.
All right. You know, the other thing too is this, is what role do the local governments play in you know, the issue of affordable housing? Because as I said in the intro, you know what? I mean, this is a great tax base now. If property values keep going up, more for the coffers. Why would they want to do anything to that?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Some governments are very proactive, and some would rather not see it in their communities.
And when you look at South Florida, which ones are more proactive?
Well, you look at the Miami-Dade County has a surtax for affordable housing. For every deed that trades, for every property that trades, some money goes to the Affordable Housing Fund, and that allows them to finance more affordable housing from private developers. You look at Mayor Jimenez, you know, he's supporting the Liberty Square program where they're redeveloping one of the larger affordable housing communities to try and make it nicer, make it safer. So you could definitely say that a lot of governments in Miami, the city of Miami, is working to try and make it happen. But you look at some of the communities in Broward, I mean, I think a lot of it was more lip service, especially some of the Western communities. From what I hear, a lot of them, they're supposed to do studies on the affordable housing needs in their community, but a lot of time the studies don't demand in more affordable housing, and the requirements that they build affordable housing, a certain percentage for each new project, a lot of times they don't make them stick with it.
And something else too, when you talk about these new developments, tell us a little bit about what are these mixed income developments and why are developers terrified of them?
Well, the mixed income is something being promoted by a lot of affordable housing developers in town. The related groups, Affordable Housing Arm, would like to do more of this. That's where you have, say, some affordable housing, traditional affordable housing, say 60% average income and below, usually with federal subsidies. And then you mix that with more units that are more market rate apartments.
All in one big area.
All in one one complex. So it might be a garden style apartment. It might be one big tower. And you have probably the affordables on the lower floors. The more expensive is on the higher floors, because that's normally how it works in those taller buildings. And then because of that, the market rate apartments will help cover the cost of the affordable apartments, where the developer is probably either losing money or breaking even on it. But of course, then that goes to be a question.
Do developers like that? Do they want to do that?
Yeah, I mean, some of the developers want to do that. I mean, the related group wants to do that. I think Pinnacle Housing, one of the larger developers, they want to do that. But does the zoning allow it? Some of the developers that focus only on upper income, would they even bother to say, include a few affordable units in there? Some of them just say, well, I'll just make it all luxury. Why bother?
All right. Let's go back to the phones before we finish up the segment. I want to go to Benjamin right now, who is in Miami-Dade. Benjamin, welcome to the program.
Hi. Well, thank you for having me. I was really interested in your segment today. I just moved into my place out here in Edgewater, like off of 26 in Biscayne. And we moved in March. We got a one bedroom for $1,400, which is considerably expensive. But we were told that this place was going to be around for at least another year, year and a half. Eventually, the plan was to knock everything down. We just got a notice last week saying that we got to be out of here by July 22nd. They're going to knock down not just this building, but every building on this whole block to make way for another huge high-rise. The development company that is doing this is a company called Metro Coma.
So you're being forced out right now.
Hmm. Yeah. We got to be out of here by July 22nd. Granted, I don't want to, demonize anyone. We did sign this on our lease that there was a chance that this was going to happen, but we were very, very almost forcibly assured that it wasn't going to happen for at least another year and a half.
Okay. Benjamin, do me a favor. I apologize only because of time. I want you to don't go anywhere. I'm going to put you on hold here for a second because I want to get your information. And we could talk to you again really soon, because that is another issue, and we have to tackle that only because of time. Just to wrap things up, though, mm-hmm. real quick, Brian, I mean, kind of going to what a caller said a moment ago, what do we see in the coming years? Is it just going to more construction costs just keep going up, forcing a lot of people out, or is there going to be some relief?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. We're seeing, they're putting a spin on we're redeveloping neighborhoods, but you're also getting rid of the affordable homes in the neighborhoods and building things that are very flashy but also very expensive. And we're going to see a lot of that in Miami. Everything planned is for the upper end. The only question is, will there be change on the political front? Will we find a way to get more money for affordable housing here? Because we pay a lot of our tax money to the federal government on affordable housing, and a lot of people say it's not distributed fairly around Florida. Like a lot of rural communities in Florida get too much of the funding, and South Florida pays all the taxes, isn't getting enough.
There'll be another election coming soon. There always is. Brian Bandel, reporter with the South Florida Business Journal. Brian, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for having me.
All right. Coming up next, what is life like for people who want to become lawyers in Cuba? And who picks the judges in Cuba? That's just ahead on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Recently, a group of U.S. lawyers were in Havana on a fact-finding trip. They were there through the Florida Bar's international section. They wanted to learn more about the legal system in the communist nation. What they learned is jaw-dropping. Students don't get to choose their law schools. There are no juries. Law students could be chosen to do a stint as a judge. What else did we learn about the legal system in Cuba? Well, joining us now is one of the folks who actually got to go on that trip, Julie Kay, reporter for the Daily Business Review. Julie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us, WLRN's America's editor, Tim Padgett. Tim, as always, great to have you.
Hey, great to see you.
All right, Julie, real quick, I wanted to ask you about this trip and this group of Florida attorneys that went to Cuba. Who were they?
About 30 lawyers went, as you said, from the international section of the Florida Bar. The Florida Bar is very cautious to say this was not sanctioned by the Florida Bar. They didn't vote on it. It's just lawyers who went. They were some top people in their fields from national law firms like Buchanan Ingersoll Rooney, Steve Zack, the former ABA, American Bar Association president, a law professor from St. Thomas University. So I had known a lot of the lawyers who went, and some spouses went as well, and I was the only journalist.
And who did they meet with? Who were they talking to?
Well, it was a very scheduled agenda, packed agenda, put together by a tour guide who specializes in Cuba travel. The first couple hours of the morning were spent meeting with lawyers, a Havana lawyer who talked about the legal system and about investment in Cuba. A Canadian lawyer who's been living there for 23 years, and the longest running foreign correspondent. And then the rest of the trip was, you know, the fun stuff and the touring and that sort of thing.
So going through your article and some of the experience, some of the things that you heard there during this meeting, again, I say jaw dropping, but I mean, what surprised you about the way the legal system works there?
Well, I mean, I frankly have not covered a lot about Cuba. I'm not Cuban American. It's not really my beat. So to me, it was all I was mostly there to learn about the investment opportunities. I cover law, business of law, and business. So the discussion that started, the first discussion that started the tour, which got me in trouble, was a young lawyer speaking very frankly about the Cuban legal system. And to me, it was a complete surprise. I don't know if others knew about the fact that, you know, there's absolutely no juries. Judges decide in the criminal, you know, the judges decide both civil and criminal person's fate. You know, the part, I guess, that was upsetting to a lot of people is that, you know, people can be thrown in prison and for 5 days without ever getting a phone call, ever contacting anyone. They don't get their file until the whole case is completed. Government can keep a file open for 6 months and then get an extension, things like that. And this young lawyer was very frank in describing everything to us.
You know what, Tim Padgett, it makes me think, I know it's a communist nation, and so like many communist nations, very secretive, but Cuba, I think, different than from the old USSR or from North Korea, China.
Right.
It's right next to us, and we have such a tie. Why is this such a surprise?
Well, on the one hand, it's not a surprise. Cuba is not the only Latin American nation, for example, that does not use a jury system. Mexico, for example, for you know, as long as anyone can remember, has not used juries. They're just now starting to move to that because Latin America is very much a Napoleonic legal system, not a common law system like we have in the United States. So on the one hand, some of that is not so unusual, but let's not forget. I mean, as we saw, for example, in cases like with Alan Gross, you know, this is not this sort of open democratic legal system that we're used to there. So and that's definitely what Julie was hearing. But as you said, I mean, a lot of this is not surprising because this is a communist system.
You know what, Julie, when you went there with these lawyers, you know, and it kind of comes back to this question of how we are able to get into Cuba in the first place. How did they get into Cuba? What was their, I guess, their explanation? And was it the same explanation for you?
I'm pretty sure it was a people-to-people exchange. And they are going to try to get some Cuban lawyers actually here. That's their goal, to attend the Florida Bar Convention later this month. I just was invited to go about a month beforehand. The Cuban...
But do you have to give a reason?
No.
And, you know, what you're there for? Is it a people-to-people exchange?
No, I didn't. It was all arranged for me by this travel agency, but it was very well known that among the group that I was a journalist. The organizer of the trip sent out an email saying there will be a member of the media with at all times. So... it wasn't a surprise to anyone, except apparently the speakers on these panels who were not notified that I was going to be there. And I guess that's why they spoke so frankly.
I think one big question, Julie, people might have is, did the lawyers group move in any way to get you a journalist visa, which is required by the Cuban government to do journalism work while you're there? Did they provide for that at all?
No, and I specifically, a colleague mentioned that to me a few days before I was to leave. Like I said, I've never had experience with this. I never particularly was hankering to go there, but it seemed like a great opportunity. So after a colleague mentioned this to me, I asked specifically, emailed the tour operator and said, by the way, do I need a journalist visa? I have the email. And she said, no, you're with this group. Everything is fine. And there were 30 lawyers there with me. So I assumed.
But at any point, you know, you're doing your journalist's duties. You're being a journalist. So you're asking questions, writing things down, maybe taking pictures or so forth. But at any point, did anybody stop and say, what are you doing?
No one said anything. And I took photos, like you said. I took copious notes. I raised my hand, asked questions. The only time that discovered this problem was at dinner the second night, when the tour guide came over to me angrily with his cell phone, upset about the headline that we had posted. You know, in retrospect, I guess if I had just waited till I got back to run the stories, which I wound up doing after that anyway, it wouldn't have been a problem. But anyway, it was a very tense night of my calling our web editor to see if we could change the headline, because I didn't want...
What was the headline?
You know how web editors kind of use more provocative headlines to get hits. I mean, that's well known. Look at CNN. It was something about the Cuban lawyer declares legal system in Cuba, quote, disgusting.
You know what, Tim? I mean, I've talked to a couple of Miami Herald reporters because I've been interested in this idea of going to Cuba, and I just wanted to know. I've asked you as well. How do I go about this? I mean, can I just be open about who I am and what I'm doing?
Well, if you are a journalist, you must get the journalist visa from the Cuban government to be able to practice journalism there without them tossing you out. And I think at one point, you know, you describe in your article, Julie, how there's some tense moments when they were sort of, you know, cracking down on you there. And I think one of the things I wanted to ask you, Julie, was did you sort of feel that you were sort of in a teachable moment there, not just for yourself, but for this the community here? Because since the normalization process began, we're seeing a lot more business people, tourists, etc., going into Cuba. And I think one of the things that maybe sometimes we're forgetting is that this is still a very restricted society. And I think your experience sort of shows us that we got to verse ourselves on the do's and don'ts. And I was wondering what you found are those do's and don'ts.
Well, I guess if you're asking if I, you know, had it to do over, if I would have gotten the journalist visa, and, you know, I don't know enough about that. I mean, I was talking to... A TV anchorwoman reporter recently. I won't mention her name because I don't know if she wants this story public, but she said the same exact thing happened to her, and she was asked to leave. So she went in through Cancun, which a lot of people used to do. I guess the question is, if you want to get fair. I didn't do it on purpose. I was just naive about this. I was invited by top lawyers. I didn't have any reason to think that there'd be a problem. I was baffled, dumbfounded when a problem arose, because I didn't go veer off on my own. I didn't go interview dissidents. Right. I stayed in the hotel right. The entire time, sat in a room. I feel bad for this lawyer that I may have gotten in trouble, but I mean, do I feel guilty? I don't say that I feel guilty. I mean, journalists go into Syria. I mean, brave journalists do things we all know sometimes. And
what was some of the tension that you were feeling, some of those tense moments? What was going on? How were they treating you?
Well, the first, that night when that happened to me, and I want to preface all this by saying I've never really wanted to be the story. In my 30 years of being a reporter, this is funny that this has happened. I've shied away from being the story, but I cannot believe the chord I struck. And it is nice that I've gotten 100 emails and phone calls from people thanking me and saying, you know, you were honest and thank you. And I'm kind of baffled. I mean, I just did my job. But as far as the tense moments that night that I described at dinner, was a very tense moment, because I'm sitting there in a foreign country. I have no phone and no internet. And thank God I had our web editor's phone number, and I did that to pacify the tour guide. You know, I'm not in a position to argue, and I was fine with changing the headline. And then when I thought things would calm down the next day, the Cuban woman tour guide who was with us supposedly went to her bosses, and then that's when they said, well, she doesn't have a journalist visa. She's not allowed to do any more writing. So, you know, I'm not... I wasn't going to fight. I didn't really want to go to prison. I said, fine, I'll wait till I get back. I wasn't kicked out of the country. I think that might be the difference, that things, maybe things are getting a little better. You know, I think I will say that what's interesting is, and I tried to get this across in some of my articles, the yearning to do business down there, the people, I think, are kind of putting the cart before the horse. They are there. I bumped into a Miami yacht broker in the lobby who went spent a week looking at real estate. People are clamoring to just get down there and do business. And it's not quite, I think maybe my experience showed that we might not quite be at that stage yet for, you know, Al Franken was there when I was there giving a press conference. We're not quite at that point.
So we're not at that point because he's thinking about the fact that here are American lawyers going to Cuba. So we find out what their system is like and how they do things. How much did they learn about how we do things in America? Did they have a chance to talk to the American lawyers about that? Did you see any of that conversation?
Not so much. Not so much.
They're going to have lawyers come up here at some point.
There were invitations made. I was there when invitations were made to them. Whether that will work out, whether they will be allowed to come or not is...
Do you think that that attorney, because he didn't know that you were a reporter, but the attorneys who were speaking, did you think that, were they being open and frank about their system because there's a need to want to express, to tell what's going on? Or, you know, why was he so confident? Do you think he was holding back maybe?
Oh, the lawyer the first day, he was not holding back at all. I mean, he said, it's disgusting. It's the same law. Our criminal, I don't want to do criminal law. And it's based on the law that was at time of the Spanish Inquisition. And he was 100% open. And someone asked him, do you feel like you can be open to the leaders? Do you have a bar association that complains? And he said they were. He said, we complain all the time. Nothing changes. So I asked him later. He did come back the next day to give another lecture. So I don't think he was that upset with me because he did come back. And I, you know, went up to him. I apologized. I said, you know, I thought you knew. I took your picture after. But he, he said, yeah, we're open to talk. Yes, we do talk and complain. But that's another story, is talking to a Miami journalist.
Julie, Cubans and Americans in business alike, they all complain about the trade embargo, that legal restriction on the kind of opening up that you were just talking, that we're not at yet. But I'm curious what you were hearing from Cubans and Americans there on the ground in Cuba as to what they feel are the most onerous restrictions, legal restrictions, be it law or just the legal system in general, that they feel is holding them back there from doing, you know, the business they want to do?
That's a good question. I mean, all this, of course, hedges on the embargo being lifted, Helms-Burton, you know, being lifted. But, you know, they want to be ready for when it happens. They all want to be ready. Now, there's already, obviously, some of these lawyers have foreign clients that are doing business right in Cuba, which I found very interesting. There was a Canadian lawyer who's living in the U.S. now, who has clients, a travel agency. So they already have clients. But their main concern, and this is, I think, what was pivotal to them, and I have a story that came out, I believe, today, about the fact that they have come back to the U.S., these lawyers, and they are not so optimistic anymore. They are not so happy because international arbitration, a rosy picture was painted. If there's a business dispute, you could do a joint venture with Cubans, with the Cuban government. The question, of course, was asked, but what if we have an issue with our partner, the Cuban government? Are we going to go to arbitration? Is it going to be honored? Right. They could not find one case of the Cuban government paying out a judgment. There was one case, and there have been a lot of cases, as you probably know, of foreign investors being thrown in jail, suddenly being charged with corruption and bribery. There's English and Canadian investors in jail. So they came back, these lawyers, I think, with actually on their fact-finding mission, with a little bit of a pessimistic view of investment.
And then we have to end it on that point. And you know, look, as relations between the two countries continue to evolve, we're going to see how that changes. Interesting that it's a group of lawyers that go down to Cuba. We'll see what, you know, if they do send any lawyers up here. But again, I want to thank Julie Kay, reporter for the Daily Business Review. Julie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And of course, America's WLRN America's editor, Tim Padgett. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right. Well, just ahead, we're going to talk about Medicaid in Tallahassee, Medicaid expansion in Tallahassee, and the U.S. Supreme Court decision that could affect more than 1 million Floridians who have Obamacare. That's just ahead on WLRN's Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Well, the Florida House is expected to vote down the latest proposal from the Senate over modified Medicaid expansion. While hundreds of thousands of Floridians are in need of that assistance, more may be surprised to know that their fate could be decided this month in the U.S. Supreme Court. Justices will decide on a case that could end the federal subsidies for more than 1 million Floridians who purchase health care or health coverage under Obamacare. If you no longer had that subsidy, would you continue buying health coverage or just pay the tax penalty? Well, joining us in studio now, Amy Driscoll, Miami Herald's health policy editor. Amy, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Dan Sweeney, Florida politics reporter for the Sun Sentinel. Dan, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, first let's start with, you know, I guess more regionally, more locally. We look at what's going on in Tallahassee. Lawmakers in a special session hashing things out. So the Senate proposes another plan, a modified plan, and really no confidence that the House is going to pass this. But Dan, what's the latest? Is the House just going to shoot this down? And where does that leave us?
Actually, by the time we're done talking here, the House may have already shot this down. You know, they only have two really major bills they're considering today, this and a tax cut policy. And they're voting on both of them today. And the House went into session at 11 a.m., so they may have already done it.
If they shoot this down, then does that end Medicaid expansion discussions for the special session, or do they just keep trying for the next couple of weeks?
Well, you know, they got to pass a budget. So eventually they need to quit beating a dead horse and move on. I mean, they've got to get a budget done. We're about to get into the next fiscal year. So if it doesn't get done today and the House votes it down, that's probably going to be the end of it.
That leads to the next question. What's the likelihood of any kind of Medicaid expansion then this session, this year?
None.
can I take that to Vegas if you're going to tell me that? All right. You know what? I mean, a lot of Floridians are waiting for this, but if it's not going to happen, then Amy, I mean, what happens to these folks? It seems like they're just going to be left out to wait another year.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that if there's no Medicaid expansion this year, we are pretty much stuck in the same spot we're in with somewhere around 800,000 people who are uninsured. And that's a difficult spot for those people for sure.
The other story that I mentioned, too, and I wonder how many people actually know about this, but there's a big decision coming up on the U.S. Supreme Court that could affect a lot of people who bought their health coverage through Obamacare. But, you know, what is this case? King v. Burwell. What is this case?
Right. Well, this is a very important challenge to pretty much the entire Affordable Care Act. It's aimed directly at the subsidies, and the subsidies are the thing that make the Affordable Care Act affordable for all these people who are in it at this point. It comes down to six words in a 1,000-page law, and the six words are for people who signed up for health care insurance under the Affordable Care Act. Did they sign up on an exchange established by the state? And that allows them to qualify for these subsidies. The challenge is whether or not the 34 states, I think it is, which do not have state-established subsidies but rely on the federal marketplace under healthcare.gov, if those states would then no longer be allowed to participate, no longer have subsidies. And that has an enormous effect. There are 7.3 million people enrolled in Obamacare. 6.4 million of them have subsidies. And in Florida, we have the most number of people who stand to lose their subsidies. 1.3 million people could lose their subsidies.
So after this decision, is it a possibility that subsidies end immediately for these folks?
Well, no one really knows what would happen. And that of course, is the big question. If that occurs, and the ruling is expected before the end of this month, no one knows if there would be a phase-out period of, you know, 6 months or 6 weeks, or if there would be a way for states to establish their own exchanges in a quick enough time period to bridge the gap. You know, that it puts the whole thing into chaos, really.
All right. And that's the question I'm going to pose to you. If these subsidies ended, does that change your decision on whether or not you're going to continue with the health coverage you have or just pay the tax penalty? Let's hear your thoughts. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Maybe a court decision that hasn't been on your mind, not something that's been covered a lot, but something that could impact, as Amy said, a lot of people in the state of Florida. And this decision, by the way, could be made, what, by the end of this month, I believe?
Right, yeah. They have to rule. They said they're, you know, this is the normal period for them to rule on everything that's still pending in front of them before the summer break. So the U.S. Supreme Court most likely will do it, you know, by the 29th, they think. And there's been a lot of speculation on that as well. Most days are Mondays when they rule. Sometimes it might be a Thursday this month. And the speculation has been if they're going to knock down the subsidies, it's most likely going to happen at the very end and they leave town.
So healthcare, obviously a big issue, you know, and I know I'm looking ahead and I shouldn't do this, but I'm just going to anyway. Looking ahead at 2016, I want to do this. You know, how big a role does healthcare play? Does that whole thing of Obamacare pop up again? But we're seeing this issue in states everywhere. Is it going to be one of the big issues?
You mean in the elections?
Yeah, for sure. Yes.
And especially with two, you know, front running Republicans coming from Miami, we're going to be looking at that really closely here. I think, you know, obviously the Republicans are saying that you know, it would be the Democrats' fault for, you know, having a bad law to begin with. And the Republicans are saying it'll be the Democrats' fault if that happens. And the Democrats will be saying the Republicans are at fault for, you know, even challenging this. But either way, I think it becomes a huge issue in all of the races and a potential for really taking over the field.
You know, coming back to Florida, and I wanted to ask Dan about this fight that Governor Rick Scott has with the Obama administration over this Medicaid expansion and over LIP. Where's that fight right now?
Well, actually, the lawsuit over LIP, LIP being the low-income pool funding that goes to hospitals for taking care of people that can't afford health care. Now, the federal government said that LIP funding could be tied to Medicaid expansion. Well, Governor Scott argues that that's not true because of an earlier Supreme Court decision that said that that you can't force states to take Medicaid expansion. So he sued the feds, and that is actually in a U.S. district court on June 19th. So we'll have some sort of an answer whether there's going to be a preliminary injunction on that day coming up pretty soon.
Has the governor damaged his reputation with his own party, considering that the House and Senate are Republican? But, you know, he's obviously taking the House's side on this debate. I mean, what has it been like, this relationship between these three, the two chambers and the governor over this issue?
Awkward.
Good word. Okay.
The governor has, although he's on the House's side, has done his best to stay out of it. He's actually not really been in Tallahassee at all the last few days. He was in the Tampa area yesterday. He's in Jacksonville today for a Chamber of Commerce luncheon. So even though he's taking their side, he's not really taking an active role. So as far as it damaging his credibility in the party, you know, you can look at what happened in Orlando a couple days ago, where six Republican presidential candidates were down there all singing his praises. So among party leaders and party officials, if anything, I think he's come out of this looking pretty good.
But he did come out just before the special session saying that, you know, there's a possibility that we're going to have a government shutdown.
It's a remote possibility. I think they're going into conference this weekend. So I think by June 20th, they will get a budget of some sort done. What it looks like and who has to take a hit and who doesn't have to take a hit, you know, that still remains to be seen.
And really, I mean, at the end, you know, how does he kind of shove this off on the legislature? How does he, you know, protect himself and I guess his reputation if things don't work out well? Does this hurt him or does it hurt the House and Senate?
Well, I mean, I think you know, the Senate really pushed this really hard. They managed to get it even into the special session. I kind of liken them to the Cleveland Cavaliers. You know, they
oh, we're going
to
talk about basketball.
They managed
now?
To get it into overtime, but they didn't quite manage to go all the way.
There might be some people in Miami who don't want to talk about the Cleveland Cavaliers right now. You know what, Amy? Also, we look at this issue of the Medicaid expansion, which could be dying as we speak. That's true, but. You know, I wondered if there's a disconnect between North and South here in Florida, and maybe that's always been the case, but, you know, the needs seems greater here in South Florida, but it almost seems like it's not being heard. But is there really a big rift between North and South when we're talking about the legislature?
Well, there's always been a rift between North and South in the legislature.
It made it worse?
I think in this case, it's probably no worse than it has been. It's really, I mean, we have more people down here in South Florida that you know, are uninsured at this point. But this has really cut across all lines, this argument, because it's Republicans versus Republicans, and they're from, you know, all parts of the state. So I'm not sure it's really about North versus South as much as it is about your political philosophy about whether or not you want Obamacare or Medicaid expansion or any sort of government money going to this sort of thing.
All right, I'm going to jump to the phones real quick and before we finish up today's program, and I'm going to go to Dwight, who is in Pembroke Pines. Dwight, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me. You know, about this whole Obamacare thing, you know, they always said be careful what you wish for. And, you know, the cynic in me really wants the Republicans to get exactly what they wish for and have this thing dissolved by the Supreme Court just so we can hang it around their neck. And on top of that, with no viable plan B, even if there was a viable plan B, all the retooling costs that these insurance companies are going to have to go through in order to make it happen, that's going to cost billions of dollars. And, you know, they're going to pass the savings on to no one, you know. So I'm really just getting a big bucket of popcorn over here, and I'm just can't wait to see these millions and millions of outrage across both party lines. Start to rally. It's going to be awesome. Great time to be in the news business.
Dwight, thank you so much for the call. Yeah, I guess it is, actually. I'm not going to complain. The other thing, too, by the way, Amy and Dan, you can answer this as well, is the other thing in the news, maybe not getting as much attention, overshadowed by this Medicaid, is the fact that the insurance companies, as Dwight mentioned, looking for a bump up, looking to increase rates. Is this normal right now, or is there something else to this?
Well, they are. They've filed their new rates for next year, and we're looking at double-digit increases for a lot of them, as there were last year. And those are for the plans that are on the exchange. They're saying it's from healthcare costs more than anything else, and that's something that the Affordable Care Act doesn't push too hard on. In its current form.
And what are lawmakers in Tallahassee saying that? I mean, so you have LIP, you get the Medicaid expansion, and now the U.S. Supreme Court can jump in, and now the cost for insurance is going to go up. What are lawmakers even? What are they feeling on this?
Well, as far as insurance rates going up, there's not really any legislation to address that. They've attempted to do all sorts of insurance policy regulation there. Governor Scott just vetoed something they tried to do on Citizens. Amy was right when she said earlier that regarding the Supreme Court decision, who knows what insurance rates are going to have to look like and how the insurance market is going to have to shift if that decision goes that way.
I get the feeling Dwight's going to have a bigger bucket of popcorn than he told us about. Amy Driscoll, again, Miami Herald's health policy editor, and Dan Sweeney, Florida politics reporter for the Sun Sentinel. Amy, Dan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You bet.
Well, finally, on the roundup, what South Florida sounded like this week with John O'Connor.
It's Friday, and this is what South Florida sounded like this week.
We have a $1.8 billion surplus. We can invest. We can have record funding for K-12 education.
It would require, in my view, the House to agree to some sort of, you know, Medicaid expansion.
Delaying really is kind of a life or death situation for a lot of people.
One of the reasons we chose the state of New York was that you can file case after case after case as long as you want on a writ of habeas corpus. Even if you lose, you just file again and file again.
Motherhood is supposed to be perfect, and women have to play this role of put on your smile.
You can hardly hear what they're saying, honestly. Just to capture those words, they killed my son.
To hear more, go to WLRN.org/thisweek.
And that will do it for the Florida Roundup for Friday, June 5th, 2015. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen to it again on the airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m., or we'll post it on our website at WLRN.org.
FloridaRoundup.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Alicia Zuckerman and Julia Duba. Our news director is Taryn Shepard. Our digital editor is Maria Muriel. Our program director for WLRN is Peter J. Mertz. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening.